Hello again. It's Michonne Neal, your resident gentleman goddess, and we're going to do yet another episode of Integrated Non-Monogamy. So, sit tight and, yes, let this earworm fill you. All right. I will finally talk about fucking compersion. I mean, seriously. What about that lovely compersion? Well, I'm here to tell you it is not just for poly-A people. Okay, so what the fuck do I mean? Well, whenever we hear about compersion, it's within a romantic poly-A context. It's supposed to be this feeling of joy that one partner gets when one of their other partners is happy, usually because they've met someone new. To romantic poly-A folks, compersion is held up as the opposite of jealousy. It's something to strive for, and it's proof that you've finally beaten the green-eyed monster, even if you still feel a twinge from time to time. But what about those of us who have no jealousy with which to compare the feeling? Or hell, what about instances where we feel joy over someone else's success, even in non-romantic contexts? What about when we cheer for our favorite sports teams and celebrate them winning? See, the thing is, I think we naturally feel compersion in a variety of situations. But people are only applauded for it and only tend to notice it when they feel it in a romantic or polyamorous context. So, let's imagine something. What if American Ninja Warrior was the standard for how we treated one another? If you're not familiar with American Ninja Warrior, it is literally the only competition that I've ever seen where literally everyone, from the competitors to the announcers and even the audience, support every single person going out there and doing their absolute best. That is true competition right there. It's never about the other players. It's all about you doing your ultimate. See, we naturally want our children, our teams, our companies, and our friends to do well. We're supportive of them, we cheer them on, and we celebrate with them when they get what they want, when they meet their goals, or when they win. We even do this with fictional characters. Yet, when it comes to romantic relationships and transitional polyamory from the dominant culture, for some reason all of that goes flying out the window. Romantic people are even encouraged to be jealous of one another. It becomes a competition in the destructive sense of the word, and everyone is set apart from day one. People view their partners with suspicion and newcomers with envy. They've learned in many ways to view their partners, or their time or love, as their property to some extent. And naturally, when that's taken away, they despise it. They want to do all they can to prevent it. Jealousy often tells them that they're losing something that's rightfully theirs. And this is also true for another reason, because, of course, there's the whole in and out group situation. So we learn to view ourselves and the people we love as one group and everyone else as the out group. And of course, anybody from outside coming in is gonna generate some suspicion and discomfort and all of that. Because we haven't learned to view everyone as being part of the same group. And I'll actually go into why that is, but in the next segment. For right now, let's focus on just purely the compersion part of this. So poly-A people, they work at their jealousy over and over. Some people give up and return to a monogamous life. Some people learn to work around it. And jealousy then becomes this ugly, never-healing sore that just kind of weeps in the background sometimes. Poly-A people work on stripping it of its power. And when they think they've succeeded, when they can feel somewhat joyful about a new love or something, they get excited about feeling compersion. But it seems like it's mostly a case of them unlearning the typical cultural messages surrounding how our relationships should look. Why is it easier for friends and parents to feel compersion rather than romantic lovers? And not to say that friends and parents don't ever feel jealous. Hell, as a disabled person, I feel jealous all the time, watching able-bodied people move around or do things and just take everything for granted. And it's not because, you know, I want them to be disabled or, you know, for it to suck. I don't exactly want to be like them, but I just, I want things to be simpler for me. I want my needs, my accessibility needs met, you know? Anyway, but a huge part of this romantic jealousy is simply a matter of a metanormativity, which is the pressure and belief that long-term romantic pair bonding with accompanying trips up that relationship escalator are the norm and are appropriate and desirable for everyone. Not even non-monogamy gets much of a pass from the effects of metanormativity. Often, the ideals from the underlying abuse culture still spill over. This is why those who seem to overcome this programming get so excited about compersion. Even still, the feeling is not exclusive to polyamory, and for aromantic people or long-term multilinkers, it is not some elusive goal. It comes more easily, or even organically, in non-familial, intimate linkings, because it's an extension of what we already feel in our other relationships. For some multilinkers, or for people who value friendships over romance, it might be easier for us to tap into our sense of compersion and to extend it to all areas of our lives, or at least into intimate context. But the point is, compersion is not something that's exceptional. It is not the sole invention nor the experience of only polyamorous people. Instead, I think it's just that those romantic poly-A people who transition from the dominant culture might just find it more difficult to express it in polyamorous relationships. All of us have certain contexts that we develop for our relationships. Built into that context are a host of expectations and norms. It is considered normal to feel great when your husband gets a raise, but not so much when he gets a new girlfriend, right? So maybe the key to compersion is not so much defeating or conquering jealousy. I don't even believe it's the opposite of jealousy. Maybe it's simply a matter of learning to be more friendly, of looking at your partner, or a few of them, with those lenses that you're able to extend to everyone else. At least hopefully, I would hope that you have the emotional literacy to not view every single person as a competition. And if you're not, well, that's something that you should probably work on. And I have tools for that. Lots of other people have tools for that. And I hope that you're able to seek out what actually works for you so you can work through that and get to that point. But anyway, getting back to this, it's also maybe simply a matter of unlearning those divisive, competitive lessons from the dominant cultures. Think about it. Why is it easier for you to be happy for your friend or your child, but not your lover? Is the root something you simply acquired from culture that triggers your jealousy instead of your compersion? Either way, however you arrive at it, just remember, you have felt compersion before. So of course you'd be able to feel it again. It's way more familiar than you think it is. It simply hasn't gone by that name outside of a romantic poly-A context because people tend to take it for granted. I recommend you take it from American Ninja Warrior. It is possible, and it's not as hard as people might make it seem. They're definitely onto something. And just remember, of course, I am personally cheering you on. Alright, so as promised, I'm going to discuss that whole in-group, out-group thing that I was talking about. It's a common term you'll hear if you've ever taken a fucking sociology class, alright? But I want to talk about it with with a term that might make both a little more sense. It might be a little what the. Anyway, so this is all about monkey spheres in particular. Now, see, the point is, ethics, they don't end when you have the love that you want. And I want you to find out here and in the, you know, throughout this podcast, why being a game changer is a continuous process. So first things first, let's explore what a monkey sphere actually is. According to David Wong, yes, of cracked.com fame, the monkey sphere is the group of people who each of us, using our monkeyish brains, are able to conceptualize as people. This concept arose first from the creation of Dunbar's number, which is a theoretical limit on the number of close social contacts that an individual human can have. It is based on data from other primate groups where there is a strong correlation between group size and the size of the brain's neocortex. Thus, extrapolating from the human cranium would put Dunbar's number somewhere between 100 and 200. Okay, fucking English, please. I know, I love to nerd out. You know, brain and mind studies was my total fucking thing, so. But let's put it in simpler language. So in other words, we rarely care about people we don't know because we fail to even conceptualize them as human beings. It's why the simple act of belonging to a group automatically others any other group. It's why atrocities such as racial cleansing, rape, and other abuses can occur on such a widespread scale. Humans are thought to have a literal limit on how many people they can actually deeply care for and keep account of. But what the hell does this mean for integration, intersectionality, and humanity? Well, it seems to indicate that it would be impossible for everyone to truly build that utopia that everyone's always dreaming about. While the concept can help build our understanding of why people appear not to give two shits about anyone, it also seems as if things will always remain that way. After all, it is an inbuilt limit on your brain, isn't it? Well, not quite. You see, humans also retain this remarkable quality to understand scale. We scale things up and down all the time. We pack enormous amounts of information into tinier packages every single day. We are masters of shifting the scale of things up or down to our personal level of understanding. The idea of a monkey sphere is just a starting place, a springboard from which we can propel ourselves in order to connect and integrate our world for the better. Our technology is now nearing levels of connection that we'd have all been burned at the stake for long ago. But human connection and emotional literacy are still in a developmental stage akin to those stake-burning times. Polyamory is kind of expanding the notion that at least some emotional literacy matters, but right now there isn't much cohesion, acceptance, or intersectionality to be seen. For the most part, it's still kind of that fun thing you do if you can afford it. It's like the green energy movement if monogamy was our go-to power plant. A nice idea in theory, but when it comes to practicality, it makes very little difference in operations, and in some cases, can actually cost you more. While polyamory might occasionally stumble across behaviors and ideas that can improve communication and relationships, it is far from the completely transformative and humanizing process it is often regaled as. Abuse can be more insidious inside of the polyamory community, in heteronormative, normalizing, and monogamous ideology each still spill over into the vast majority of the non-monogamous world. Very few people realize the immense unexplored world lying just beyond their myopic sight. And it might be due to that whole monkey sphere thing I mentioned earlier. And even though I make reference to a lot of, it's weird because as blind as I am, I use a lot of very visual imagery and metaphors and things. And It's not because I think sight is so fucking important or anything like that. It's because my particular brain works based off of visualization, not off of my actual sight. At least not directly. My eyesight is, well, we'll get into that later. So if you are blind or visually impaired or whatever like that and listening to this and just wondering, oh my gosh, will they fucking stop, you know, talking about being blind and all this. I know. I get you. But keep in mind where we are talking about a lot of this is willful shit or just stuff we haven't learned. So it's like, even if when you're blind and, you know, they give you some fucking glasses or contacts and you can see for the first time, you know, or see things clearly, it's like, wait a minute, what the fuck is that? Like, if you have no context for it, you're not going to be able to recognize it. And it's that sense in which I'm talking about, being unable to see something and everything. And of course, you know, over time, I am searching for much better language to get these points across. So I'm sorry if, if it doesn't quite do it for you, but this is the best I can do right now. And, you know, I can just try to do better in the future. So I just wanted to make note of that. And thank you for listening, if you still listen this far. So anyway, back to monkey's fears. What is actually effective? How can we concentrate on true emotional literacy while respecting our inherent limits? How can non-monogamy grow in practicing intersectionality without tokenizing humans, without ignoring alternate experiences, and without fizzling out into the same sort of normalcy that oppresses others? Well, it's doing that thing that many people have learned to be afraid of. It's innovating, it's creating, it's truly taking the path never trod. It's about not getting comfortable and settling into this sort of complacency that lets terrible shit slide and go unexamined. It's about taking our limits and making them our bitch. Translation, reshape the fuck out of that monkey sphere. Make it work for you. It's something that I've repeatedly done over the years. Humans have done it with the natural world many times over. Our technology, our improved quality of life, and our ability to understand the cosmos is proof of it. Our brains are capable of so much. It can store so much more than we realize. And when it truly sinks in that our ability to change our stories, for better or worse, is actually what saves or kills us, then we'll know exactly how to take advantage of our monkey's fears. Though each individual may have their own particular numerical limits, the ways that we define the categorization of our monkey's fear can be useful. How? Well, it goes back to that other crack.com article that I mentioned way back when in a written post, where the main thing was to take a longer view of what humanity is. People walk around as if they are separated from history, as if the choices that we make today aren't affecting the world tomorrow, and as if we're islands. While individuality is the whole point of being as conscious as we are, we can never forget the background upon which it acts and which it reacts to. Epigenetics has a very real effect on families and different races. The past horrors that Jews, women, queers, and people of color, and yes, even left-handed people, and others have experienced, have effects that can still be felt now, and that will still be felt in the future via intergenerational trauma and other intergenerational legacies. We cannot pretend like it had some neat and definable end, because there never was one. That's one of those toxic and divisive ideas that we can act right now. The one that humans, experiences, and events are somehow of a particular shape that can be mathematically accounted for. Just as women, queers, disabled folks, and black people still encounter the effects of human history and tragedy, so will our children and their children until we do some shit about it. Time is not a healer. Time in itself does fuck all. There has to be some actual process going on for the time to even matter, okay? So, there was one day that my longest-term partner, they finally realized something that will help him to become an even better father. He was watching our son play, and he turned to me and he said, "You know what? I'm not just his father. I'm teaching him how to be a father to his children," and on and on. "I'm not simply raising him. I'm raising the generations to come." So just as our past is ours to heal, our present is our chance to build the future. Thinking of the future and the past as disconnected from our present lessens our ability to make better decisions. It keeps us thinking small and behaving in inconsiderate, ignorant, abusive, and horrific ways towards one another. It hacks our monkey's fears into a barely comprehensive mess of people that are more likely to be acquaintances than actual genuine friends. We who have these amazing conceptual, technological, and rational abilities have failed to reinvent and rebuild the part of our life that we swear means the most to us, our connections with ourselves and other people. Instead of categories and labels being applied to human beings with the understanding that they're transitive, they have become these placeholders that serve to erase individuality, truth, and capability. Humans are being dragged down to their lowest and being contorted in order to be quote-unquote normal and acceptable. When will we finish with this notion of normality among humans for good? When will we overcome or reinterpret our monkey's fears? When will we start practicing a human-first ethos and building our laws accordingly instead of using this deductive and endless method of one approved group at a time? When will we start seeing ourselves as all that we truly are instead of passing on the narratives, misinformation, and limitations from the past? If you find that you can't expand the number of people in your monkey sphere, you can still make damn well sure that only those who expand your world are a part of it. Right? So until we take a non-erasured form of integration, education, and ethics forward, we will continue to be enslaved to the limits, to useless suffering, to the lowest, and to each other. All right? And we can learn how to do that. It will be all right, I promise you. So, if you like what you're hearing and want to directly support me, there are now subscription options, monthly subscription options. So, sign up. And if you do, you might just find yourself with access to the Metanoic portal for free. Hey, that sounds pretty sweet to me. So, go ahead, try it out. So there's this term that I really like to use called unchained, and some other people use it, but I would like for you to know what I mean when I use it. So before I knew the words non-monogamy, polyamory, relationship anarchy, and open relationship and other terms like that, I just lived it organically. And due to my locus within various systematic oppressions, the difficulties that I encountered had nothing to do with jealousy or dismantling of metanormativity or the can't find a date woes. When I finally did discover the mainstream non-mono communities, I actually grew so disgusted with the unexamined and rather abusive approaches to love that were running rampant. So I did what I always do, which is to create something that got to the root and that restored the queer black history of non-monogamy, and also that promoted an educated consent model that was lacking pretty much anywhere else. Intersectional non-monogamy was not meant to be some buzzword which was watered down and co-opted like compersion usually is. It was a specific lens through which to view the world, an action-oriented set of practices. And the origin goes way beyond the surface to start from the very root of all of our definitions of love, loyalty, needs, and ethics. Right? And that's what I mean. It's really puzzling that there are a lot of, especially non-black people, using intersectional non-monogamy to describe certain things, or, you know, or to try to have or lead discussions about it. And it makes no sense, because how can you speak to something that's not your experience and that you haven't ever really been, nobody's asked them to talk about this. I don't know. At least not the people who have the experience, you know? I mean, it's one thing, but if you're going to be a spokesperson for it, you should probably, you know, consult the people who, you know, the main people. I don't know. Anyway. So, unlike many poly-A folks, I never transitioned into being non-monogamous. I had always liked or loved more than one person and always been an organic multilinker. It never made sense to me to arbitrarily limit affection, love, and time into one person. The idea of expecting one person to be everything you wanted and needed was strange to me. It still is, honestly. Things like veto power, identifying primarily as a couple, and making assumptions were never the norm for me. In some ways, it's difficult for me to conceive of the things that do make people jealous, and that sense of ownership of another person in particular. And those rules that are set up to protect relationships instead of people. I have always valued autonomy, questioned every assumption, and approached people as human beings first and foremost. I want the truth most of all, no matter how much it hurts, because I've survived worse. My time is so precious, and each moment is new. Yet the majority of people don't experience the world this way. Where I performed thought experiments and tracked ideas to their logical conclusions, other people must work layer by layer to get in touch with what lies beneath society's veneer. I never viewed relationships as being either or. I let people I was interested in know how I felt, and then I let them do with the information whatever the hell they pleased. I never spent months or years dancing around the issue and wondering, what if? I found that most people simply said no, either right off the bat or later on after a bit of trying, because they couldn't quite get the hang of polyamory, or because they thought that they had to respect my relationship with my longer-term partner. But it was never because they didn't realize that they had other options. Or at least not for... It wasn't a lack of me letting them know they had other frickin' options. I remained friends with those who wanted to and let others go. I don't know if being aromantic and autistic makes this kind of thing easier for me than others, but it probably has something to do with it, since I'm not quite caught up in all of the, you know, the usual social norms and things, you know? I just do what makes sense. My relationships, including those of my teen years and even preteen years, you know? Basically, every relationship that I've had, you know, probably had my first boyfriend at age 5, but even then, none of my relationships ever ended dramatically. There was no yelling or screaming or attempted murder, though there have been tears sometimes. There was one guy who was not my partner, but we did end up having to beat him up because there were some extenuating circumstances. It was a person I think met with like once, and it was just, yeah. Anyway, I can go over that sometime much later. The point is, the people that I was with, we never broke up because somebody else demanded that we do it. Each relationship that I ever had ran its natural course. Most of them ended amicably, even if they ended sadly. The one that ended very abruptly was, of course, when my partner unexpectedly died. But other than that, there was no real drama in the endings of any of my relationships. They just developed or shifted organically. With my longest-term partner, there was some issue with that. There was very high possibility of abuse for one of our kids, and so I basically had to remove them from the situation until I could figure out what the hell was going on. And of course My parents stepped in a very not helpful way, and my partner ended up going to jail. But it's, you know. But, you know, the point is, there's no, even now, there's no, like, animosity or ill will between us, at least not on my part. You know, and we are just doing our best to make sure the kids are taken care of and everything. Don't exactly consider ourselves partners anymore, but it's just, I don't know, it's this nebulous space that we're not allowed to exist in, right? Things always have to be fucking defined and shit, but I don't know, whatever. I know we're gonna be in each other's lives probably for, you know, the rest of our lives. I don't mind that. In what capacity and in what levels? Who knows? That's for us to fucking figure out later. Anyway, but see, because I know, knowing firsthand what it is to have a lack of choice and lack of self-determination, I always made sure to offer space and a free choice to those who are in my life. And this is what the norm would be under a decolonized or completely uncolonized culture. Many stories in the Kuhlverse are actually built upon non-coercion, organicity over a metanormativity, and on the notion that friendship as being valuable in and of itself. There were problems, of course. There were incompatibilities, as always, you know. There was some jealousy, but it never fell on another person to fix someone else's issues. There were no sides taken. There was no ganging up on one person. No holding of any one relationship above the individuals that were in them. It was simply us talking about expectations, feelings, and needs. Oh, you know what? Isn't it the kind of shit that, you know, especially people within polyamory are always touting that they want to do, and yet nobody ever seems to actually fucking do it? I don't know, whatever. The point is, when we learned we wanted or expected different things, I would thank them for the experience and then release them to the universe to find what the fuck they actually wanted. It didn't stop it from hurting. It didn't mean that things weren't exciting. the bit I mentioned earlier about the kid's dad, you wouldn't fucking believe some of the crazy shit that my longest term partners and I've been through together experienced, and they're just me by myself, like, seriously. But, you know, like I said, it's another story, and maybe I'll talk about it someday. Maybe I will invite him on here to discuss it. Who knows? We'll see. If there's interest in it, I guess I can do that. It's whatever. Anyway, from a very, very early age, I was used to being alone. I was always very close with my siblings. My older sister and I are still thick as thieves, and we raise our children together on and off. But, you know, still, I spend the majority of my time alone. It's just the nature of the, you know, being multiply marginalized and having multiple disabilities, especially with chronic pain and all that. It just does not leave much time for the quote unquote niceties of life. When you're poor and fucked up, it's kind of hard to get out and do stuff, you know. Anyway, so on top of a multitude of experiences that were and presently are unique to me, I knew that the only constants in my life were going to be solitude and change. I enjoy people as they come. I never ask for more than anyone can give. And I let them know off the bat that I wouldn't be owned or boxed in. And that's from the very beginning. Unfortunately, this often means that I end up in a teacher or therapeutic role for other people. I'd be the one they came to for advice. And I had to learn to set... I did have to learn to set new boundaries. For those who just tend to want to use me as a sounding board and not, you know, like, just because. And that's the thing, too, is this whole conceptualization of friendship as just being something different than at least how I conceive it to be, you know. For me, a friendship is so much more than a romantic relationship could be, and it requires other things. But people aren't used to that, and so if you are a friend, you're either a dumping ground or you're somebody they can get certain things from or somebody they can forget things with or things like that, you know, but that's not how I roll. Anyway, I mean, it could be because I'm left-handed and autistic, you know, but I've always been a very highly compassionate person. And many people, even strangers, sense this. The broken, they all want and need help. It took me way too many years to finally admit I couldn't save anyone, nor did I want to. I definitely didn't want anyone ever to try to save me, nor even understood what they thought they could save me from. I finally learned to extend that sort of educational autonomy to them as well. Because see, the best teacher is often nature itself. And no matter how helpful you are, you won't be around forever. It's good to assist people, but that person themselves, they have to do the heavy lifting. Because they are going to be the most reliable person that they'll ever know. So being able to limit my role as a crutch helped me better advocate for the relationships I actually wanted. The only thing that you owe to another person might be money. I mean, hello, reparations. Come on now. Everything else, it's voluntary. And I didn't, and still don't, demand respect, love, or any other resource from anyone. But the people that I invest in, they offer these things freely because they choose to. That longest-term partner I was telling you about, he started off wanting to save me. Later on, felt he had a duty to me, which, felt that he had to repay his debt to me somehow. I shot him down every time, every single time. No matter what, I want to be chosen, not needed, owned, or owed. I started rather early in my life, around age 12, when I first started writing. And, you know, nearly two decades later, it's become much easier to express and discuss in particulars what it is that I am open to. I don't even want to say seeking or, you know, or whatever, because it's the connection is going to be based on the dynamic between me and that person and what we can and what we want to build together. Nothing about my life has ever been remotely normal. And as I look around at other people's stories, I realize that definitely includes my love life. So this is the overview. Maybe one day I will tell you the whole tale. And if you want to see some of this in practice, my stories are full of atypical yet intersectional relationships. Even a few of my own.